Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. My name is Andy Cutchins, Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program here, and I'm delighted to be moderating this discussion today on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization at 10 years. What is the future? Now, some of you might be wondering, why are we doing this discussion on the Shanghai Cooperation at 10 years when the 10-year anniversary is not until next month? And in fact, the meeting in Shanghai to celebrate the 10-year anniversary is not until July. Is that correct? Well, that gets to the point that I wanted to take an opportunity to have this discussion and introduce to Washington our latest visiting scholar who has arrived from Shanghai, from Fudan University, Dr. Zhao Huasheng, who arrived here a couple of weeks ago. And I wanted to make sure that everyone got a chance to start meeting him and knowing him. Dr. Zhao is a visiting fellow now with us. Since 2005, he's been professor and director at the Center for Russia and Central Asia Studies, as well as director of the Center for Shanghai Cooperation Organization Studies at Fudan University in Shanghai. He has served as vice chairman of the Chinese Society for the Study of Sino-Russian Relations since 2008. And from 1989 to 90, Mr. Zhao was a visiting scholar at the Moscow Institute for International Relations. From 1986 to 2004, he was a research fellow and director of the Department of Russia and Central Asia at the Shanghai Institute for International Studies. His principal areas of research include Sino-Russian relations, relations between China and Central Asia, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organizations. And he has published many, many analytical articles in Chinese, Russian, and English. And his most recent book is Central Asia, Views from Washington, Moscow, and Beijing. It was co-authored with our good friends Gene Rumer and Dmitry Trenin. Let me introduce our other speaker, because it's always a pleasure to find an excuse to invite Alex Cooley down to Washington and share his wisdom with us. And congratulations are in due. Alex has a relatively new title. He is now the Toe Professor of Political Science at Barnard College in New York City, meaning full promotion, full professor, and he can do whatever the heck he wants.
It's time to become academic deadwood.
He's also a faculty member, of course, at the Columbia Harriman Institute and Salzman Institute for War and Peace Studies, and teaches at the Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. Alex's research examines how external actors, including international organizations, multinational companies, non-governmental organizations and foreign military bases and others have influenced the development and sovereignty of the former Soviet states, with a particular focus on Central Asia and the Caucasus. His first book, Logics of Hierarchy, was Cornell University Press 2005. It was winner of the Marshall Shulman Prize, the American Association for the Advancement of Slavic Studies. That's a big deal. That's for the best book published in the previous year in the field. Congratulations. He has a couple of other books that look at base politics as well as contracting states. But right now, Alex is working on a new book that looks at the interests of the United States, Russia, and China, and their competition for influence in Central Asia. It's got a great working title, Great Games, Local Rules. Emphasis on the latter. So, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, been around 10 years, emerged out of the Shanghai Five. Some have pointed to this as a possible anti-NATO. The other side of the spectrum would suggest the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is an insignificant actor and not worthy of discussion or much thought. My own view is that the truth is likely somewhere in the middle, and I will turn it over now to Zhao Huasheng and then Alex Cooley to enlighten us and stimulate our thoughts about this for our discussion today. Thanks.
Thank you, Andy, for your introduction. I'm really very honored to be here, have a chance to share my opinions with with you on the topic of this year, because particularly because this year is the 10-year anniversary of ACU. So in China, in Central Asia, inside the state members of ACU, there are a lot of conferences. And so this is a hot topic, I think, in China, in Central Asia, inside ACU. I'd like to begin our serious topic with a light start. This is a landmark of one of the landmarks of Shanghai. It's a new district region of Shanghai. We say in China that China is one state, two systems, social system in mainland and capitalist system in Taiwan, Guangdong, and Macau. Two systems and three countries. Developed countries, developed country, developing country, and underdeveloped country. Sure, this is one part of the developed country. But I'd like to direct your attention to this building. This is a hotel, Shangri-La Hotel. The owner is a Hong Kong person. And actually, this is a place where the Shanghai Cooperation Organization was born. So the celebration, the summit of Shanghai, the first summit of Shanghai Cooperation Organization was held here. Now you see this. This is the International Conference Center of Shanghai. Here, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization celebrated its fifth anniversary. So they have relations with ASEAN. This is opposite side of the river. So it's a very good location for holding so important mirrors for China, because you can see the most beautiful, not only series, but achievements in past years. That's why Shanghai and China choose this location as a place to hold this important mirror. We know Shanghai Cooperation Organization, first of all, is regarded as an organization for secret cooperation. I think so. I agree with this. And I think here in the area of secret cooperation, most successors have been achieved. It's an area where Shanghai Cooperation Organization works most successfully. Why? And what results? I think the most of results, successful results, can be explained in as follows. The first thing Shanghai Cooperation Organization pursues is to create a legal foundation, a legal basis for cooperation in secret areas. This is the first thing Shanghai ACU pursues. And here, in this area, a lot of treaties or political documents are achieved, such as the Shanghai Convention Against Terrorism, Separatism and Extremism, such as the Convention Against Terrorism, such as a long-term treaty of good neighborhood and cooperation, multilateral treaties. So it's, why it's important? Because it's created the legal basis. We know most of the member states of Shanghai Cooperation Organization are Eastland states. And for example, there are about 3,100 Uyghurs live in Central Asia, mostly in Kazakhstan. And a lot of organizations, movements of East Turkestan. So first of all, you have to make a legal foundation that in accordance with the international law, in accordance with the domestic law. So and I think SU have reached great success in this area. And then the second important thing, the important result, is that is creation, formation of a lot of mechanisms or institutions for cooperation in secret areas. The most of them, the most important of them is one, we know, except besides the general secretary, there is only one permanent institutions inside ASEO, that is the regional anti-terrorism structure, which is located in Tashkent. The most important function of this organization is to collect, analyze, and share information related to terrorism or acts of terrorist groups. So sure, it has a lot of other functions. And besides a lot of meetings as institutions for cooperation, such as the meetings of presidents of Supreme Court, but they meet not very frequently, and I think up to now they meet only twice in past years. But the chief procurators met much often. They met up to now about 8 times. So they are representatives of legislature institutions of every state members. Besides, and they are meeting of secretaries of secret council. And meeting, they have met 5 times. And the meetings of defense ministries once in a year. The last one is in this year. And recently, there's a new meetings, that is meetings of the chiefs of general staffs. So this year, they have the first meeting in China. Besides, sure, there's meetings of heads or ministers of secret ministry, domestic secret ministries, or public ministry of public securities. This is the main institutions inside Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And then Shanghai SEO conduct military exercise. And up to now, altogether, Shanghai SEO have conducted 7 military drills, most with different names. But the most important one is a peace mission. Peace mission 2005, 2007, 2009, and 2010. This is the most important one. But what are the limits of SEO in secret cooperation areas? They're sure they have some limits. To my observation, the most successes that achieved inside the SEO are in the non-traditional areas. SEO doesn't deny normal cooperation in the traditional areas, normal cooperation in defense areas, but most successes achieved in non-traditional areas. So when you enter into traditional areas, sure, there are some achievements, but the results are not so so big, at least. But sure, the limit is set out by SU itself from on the one hand, but on the other hand, I think there are also more problems or more difficulties. And when we can observe progress of cooperation in security areas from past years, but mainly as expansion inside the area of non-traditional areas, not enter from non-traditional area to traditional. So this is my observation. Then, the progress, second, progress and problems of economic cooperation. Economic cooperation of ICO is very high valued inside ICO, and there's opinion, some people argue that it's the most important thing for ICO to do, and it should be put in the first place of the agenda of ICO, particularly in among the scholars of China and among scholars of Central Asia. Actually, ICO is quite ambitious in its planning of economic cooperation. And in the first years of, in the 2003, ICO have dropped up a plan called the Outline of Multilateral Economic and Trade Cooperation. This is a roadmap, a blueprint for ICO for economic cooperation. This is, the plan is consists of three steps, strategy. The first step for short term, just to facilitate the conditions for trade and investment. Then the second step is to implement, realize multilateral, large-scale multilateral economic investment and trade. Then the third step is to implement free movement of commodities, capitals, services, and technologies. This is a three-step strategy of ICO for economic cooperation. And a lot of governmental ministries or agencies have been involving in economic activities such as customers, transportation, and finance, energy, information and communication, agriculture, science and technology, and environmental protection, and so on. They have regular meetings. That, besides, there's also non-governmental institutions such as Council of Businessmen and Union of Banks. They work in parallel with the governmental line. But however, I think economic cooperation underwent certain difficulties, and the result there is progress and great progress and results, but the results I don't think are as satisfying as expected. There are a lot of reasons. The first one, I think, though every state member, including Russia, have interest in economic cooperation, but the priorities and tasks for them are too different, quite diversified. So politically, generally, they are common in promoting economic cooperation, but every state member have its own priority. This is one reason. Then there's the gap of economic might among the state members is so huge. Generally speaking, the gap of economic might is not necessarily the obstacle for economic cooperation. In some cases, maybe it could serve as a stimulating factor, but it's not for the case of Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Because China is too strong economically, and in face of China's strong economy, some state members have some certain concerns to be in the economic advantage to Chinese economy, to becoming resource providers just to Chinese economy. So from this point of view, they have some concern. It makes them a little reluctant to, for example, to the idea of free movement of commodity services and investment, and particularly for migration. And because of this, it's difficult to realize, to put out forward idea of free economic zone as China is carrying out in some other surrounding regions. Even Russia has shares such concern. So this is another reason. And the third, I think, ASEAN suffers from lack of sustained commercial financial sources to support its projects. Actually, ASEAN worked out or put forward more than 100 economic projects, but you have to find money to support these projects. Up to now, ASEAN totally rely on the China's credit. Totally rely on Chinese credits, no other resources. It's almost a long history about formation of Shanghai Cooperation Organization back, but it's still underway. It's not formed yet. So no commercial sustained financial source. This is also a problem that I still have to resolve. And fourthly, underdevelopment of market economy and insufficiency of law enforcement, unfavorable climate, investment climate, as particularly in Central Asia. No matter what great ideas or plans you have, but they are difficult to be realized if the investment and trade climate is not good. This is the fourth main obstacle, main reason. However, I do not have pessimistic opinion or perspective on economic cooperation of ASEAN, because the economic cooperation is so needed for every state member. The economic interest is so natural, so needed for every state member. So the question is just slow or quick, but not back or forth. It's progressing. This is a general trend. Just ASEAN should find more optional methods and approaches. This is about economic. Then the next talk is enlargement. Where? Enlargement, I think, is turning to be a more practical issue instead of only a theoretical one from last year. And I think that the enlargement of SDA should follow four guiders. That is, the first one is geographical guide. Among the state members of SDA, there's a consensus that new state members should come from this region. But what this region implies, that is a question. I think this region should not be understood as a region around the state members of ICO. ICO, which includes, for example, China and Russia, have so many members. Take them as a surrounding member countries as ICO, but they are located too far away from ICO for some European states and neighboring with Russia and the states of Southeast Asia. Obviously, they're not proper candidates. So, to my understanding, that this region should be understood as a region surrounding Central Asia, just Central Asia. This is a geographical guide. Then the political guide. Political guide, as you said, to understand that every new state members should share the political ideas, conceptions of SDA, should abide by its regulations. This is natural. And then the guide of efficiency. Maybe as clear, the guide of efficiency. That means the coming of new state members should bring new dynamics, but not new problems. Should not decrease the efficiency of SDA. Should not change the create contradictions inside ICO. But surely the deciding mechanism, decision mechanism of ICO as a consensus, based on consensus, not every state members have to agree it, but not object to it. That is the consensus. Sure, the more state members, the difficult to get consensus. Mm-hmm. So it will make the SU a little more difficult to get consensus. That's natural. But the most important, it did not bring constructural obstacle inside ICO, constructural, that the fixed and permanent positions among state members. That is what should be avoided. This is efficiency. And I think there is another guide of that, guide of themes. I mean, the new state members just join the structures and themes the join of new state members should not change the structure, should not change the themes talks of ICO. They just can enrich the talks, and make the structure more big, but it should not change it. This is a guide of themes. And who's the possible candidates according to these four guiders? I think these are states. Turkmenistan and Mongolia Among all the possible candidates, Turkmenistan and Mongolia appear to be the most suitable candidates. You see, I do not think there would be any objections from any state members to join off these two state members. But the problem is that both of them haven't applied for formal membership. So until they show their interest, sure, they will not be the former members of SCO. Afghanistan is also very close to SCO in terms of the four guiders. From a long-term point of view, I think Afghanistan's access has a natural rationality for long. But given the unstable situation inside Afghanistan and given the unpredictable future of Afghanistan and given the dominant influence of the U.S., the possibility of Afghanistan at present time is very, very small, and the Afghanistan government officially said they do not have to apply, they did not apply for membership, at least at present time. Then Iran. Iran has support from inside of ISIL, that is Tajikistan. Tajikistan backs the join of Iran. And Iran is one of the states that officially applied for membership of ISIL. But Russia has made it clear that states and UN sanctions should not be accepted by ISIL. That is for the possibility of Iran to be the membership of ISIL at least before the sanctions of UN removed as impossible. Then in terms of geographical guide and the terms of guide of themes, Turkey is also close to ISIL. But as a member of NATO, as Turkey's access is, I think, very, very small, or impossible. But I think it doesn't deny the possibility of formation of some kind of context, dialogue, or relationship, some kind of, because Turkey is so interested in Central Asia. And it's possible, and it's rational. And it's also, I think, it maybe also have some interest. At least some state members have interest. This Caucasus states, at present time, Caucasus states are out of sight of ISIL. And Georgia, the relationship, we know the Georgia relations with Russia, and Georgia is take itself as a European state, not Asian state. We take it as Asian state. And finally, India and Pakistan. India has never expressed its wish to join ASEAN as a formal, but I guess being inside ASEAN, India would be given a very good chance or opportunity to expand its influence in Central Asia. It is very desired by India. So supposing ASEAN invites, I guess India may positively react to it. Maybe. And Russia very much advocates for India's join. Russia publicly support the join of India. However, given that India is a very huge existence, and its join may bring dual effects to ASEAN. On the one hand, it may significantly end the geopolitical weight of ICU. But on the other hand, it could create problems as well in terms of efficiency and seems. Not sure India have more interest in the affairs of South Asia. Maybe it can change things. So if China takes India, I think it's a very risky step for ICU. It's risky. It has some advantages, but they also have some risk. And so ICU should very carefully deal with this problem. This problem, and I think some of state members, particularly Central Asian state members, also have their idea about the possibility of India's join. Maybe it make India is so huge, it make the Central Asia members not so important. Maybe they have their ideas. Mm-hmm. And Pakistan is the one that with strongest desire to be inside ICU as a former member. But due to the complicated domestic situations and difficult regional relations, ICU responds to Pakistan's enthusiasm as with caution. Personal understanding is that Pakistan's join is possible, but it's more possible to be considered in a package solution together with India. That would not make the create disbalance in the South Asian region, South Asia region. Otherwise, it can create disbalance. It's, this is about. Have I too long?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Oh. So we can discuss it later. And I turn to the conclusion. ICU is going to celebrate its 10th anniversary in this June in Kazakhstan, and it will mark the end of a period and a beginning of a new time for ICU. And for near and middle future, what the most important tasks and what the most important, the main challenges? My answer is, the first, ICU should maintain political solidarity because the change, the situation in Central Asia and beyond Central Asia and is undergoing some very significant changes. It's a general. So in the face of new situation and conditions, ICU should maintain political solidarity is one of the most important things for ICU to do. The second, to increase efficiency, make it more effective in everything. The third, bring more and visible economic results, visible, particularly to Central Asian states. And the fourth is properly manage the enlargement, which I said about it. And the fifth is whether the possible regional instability and change successfully. I just missed it, this topic, because of no time. It's also a challenge and dilemma for ICU. Yeah, from the history of color revolutions in 2005 and from the history of last year's event in Kyrgyzstan, we have a feeling that the ICU found itself in a very difficult position in face of these problems. And up now, I do not think I still find the way out from this dilemma. And I hope it's a wrong prediction. And with the event of last year in Kyrgyzstan, Central Asia maybe is entering into a new round of instability for the years to come. I hope it's a wrong prediction. And finally, not to fail in the conception with other institutions and organizations. Both outside of the region, the institution outside of the region, and inside, I mean the institutions dominated by Russia. Because, you see, for China is proud of ICU because it's the only organization that initiated by China, and its headquarters is located in China and named after Chinese city. But most importantly, it's the only one platform, multilateral platform, and all organizations for China in Central Asia. But as for Russia, for Central Asian states, they have much more institutions or organizations to cooperate with. That's not the only way. So, for example, Kazakhstan is very in favor of more active access of EU or what by the European Organization of Security or OSCE, and ICU have challenges. ICU should not fail in the competition with other institutions. That's my conclusion. Thank you for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Huasheng. I'm sorry to cut short your presentation a bit, but I know that we're going to return to some of your other slides. Let's turn the floor over to Alex, who had a long train ride down here this morning from New York.
That very generous welcome. One of the nice things about becoming academic Deadwood now is I can just cancel my office hours on a whim, so I can do a lot more of these functions. So it's always a privilege and an honor to address CSIS, and it's wonderful to be here with Huasheng, who is one of the most meticulous and insightful scholars of Central Asia, not only in China, but anywhere you might find. So I should just mention that most of this research draws upon a fellowship I had with OSI to study the SCO and dynamics and formulate some recommendations to policymakers here in Brussels. And this material is being folded into this book project that Andy described at the outset. So what I want to do is kind of bundle the issue of the history of the SCO with Western perceptions of the SCO and see how these perceptions have turned out in terms of analytical predictions over the last decade, and see where the organization might be going. Here's the map.
Here's the logo up on the upper right-hand side.
So one of the things that drew me to this as an international relations scholar are proclamations like this. This one's from Chinese National News Service, talking about the SCO. And italicized, it is of immense significance in the search of the international community for the establishment of a new type of international relations. Well, if there's a new type of international relations, I want to know about it. And I'm absolutely fascinated as to what the dynamics might be. And one of the themes I want to explore is that most of the challenges that the SCO faces, and I actually almost completely agree with Huasheng in terms of his assessment of the sort of security versus the economic side, are actually very common to international organizations. There might be one or two that are SCO-specific, and so that's another analytical theme I want to talk about. So first view, and these views are formulated in reaction to sort of things that the SCO has done. was post-Astana, post-Color Revolutions, and the declaration in July 2005 at the SCO summit that U.S. military bases in the region had served their purpose and should be put on a timetable for withdrawal. A few days later, Uzbekistan evicted the U.S. from K2. Donald Rumsfeld, then Secretary of Defense, said, it looks to me that the big guys are bullying the little guy here, trying to blame sort of the SCO mechanism for what was in fact a U.S.-Uzbek spat bilaterally. And in fact, it was Karimov, we now know, at the Astana meeting that took this draft to Putin, not the other way around, who was back then delighted to put this in the declaration. So the causality runs reverse there. But in any case, that prompted a wave of analysis. Could the SCO be an emerging anti-Western bloc? Could it be an anti-NATO type of bloc? And you've had some analysis along those lines. Also, 2005, the height of political instability in terms of regime change, fears of colored revolutions, the so-called freedom agenda going on in the Middle East, and so forth, and this kind of securitization of democracy promotion actors by the Central Asian states themselves, right, and viewing democracy promotion as a security threat, right? And so all of that converges at that time. In academia, Steve Walt, Bob Pape brought up this term sort of soft balancing, right? When you can't hard balance, you engage in soft balancing. So you deny access rights, you deny legitimacy, you criticize unilateralism, and the SCO is one of the cases that they use in their writings. Also, there was also, along this theme, real concern that Iran might join around 2006, 2007. And Putin back then announced an interest in forming an energy club, right, and which was interpreted as a possible gas cartel, which if you put the gas resources together, so Russia and Iran and China and Uzbekistan would potentially amount to the majority of known reserves in the world. So that was another driver. Now, as it's happened, this kind of convergence of interest on the part of China, on the part of Russia, on the part of Central Asian states, and pushing back at perceived Western influences really peaked in 2005 and 2006. And what you see now are some splits, what I call sort of a split in the Russian-China security agenda, and along the issue of splitism. And this was brought forth by the Georgia War. So both Moscow and Beijing on the same page regarding the Colored Revolutions. Georgia War, or really the aftermath of the Georgia War. I mean, most Chinese analysts I've spoken to, you know, saw Russia's intervention and what they perceived as a response to aggression in South Ossetia as legitimate, but what they couldn't get on board with was the recognition, right? The recognition of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. So we have the Dushanbe summit in 2008. Medvedev goes to the summit. By some accounts, he's expecting maybe he get the Kyrgyz, maybe he get the Kazakhs. Instead, he gets quite a firm rebuke with a strong statement of territorial integrity being reaffirmed by the SCO. Apparently, there's a meeting between Chinese delegation, American ambassador at the airport in Dushanbe. Some Russian reporters commented on this. And really, from the Central Asian states I've talked to, there were also independent decisions that when it comes down to it, recognition is not in our interest. It is not in our interest to validate sort of the creation of new states. And this was pretty strongly felt. Also concerned that the sort of dispersal of passports, right, to Russian citizens could be used as a pretext for potential military involvement. That was also expressed as a concern in some of these places. One other thing that we see post-2008 in this rebuke, we see Russia tacking away from the SCO and starting to promote the CSTO as a mechanism, right? So we see official declarations. No, we believe the CSTO should be a partner for NATO. We believe the West should cooperate with the CSTO in Afghanistan. It's an established organization, has a structure, it has capacity, and so forth. So we see a little tilt away from Moscow post-Georgia. We also see the establishment of the Northern Distribution Network. Being here with Andy, I don't need to tell you anything about that, but just to say that the U.S. military is continuing its cooperation, logistical cooperation with the Central Asian states that the SCO in this kind of anti-West framework did not drive the U.S. out. But again, I think this is a very specific time, and now you've seen some ruptures. Oh, just to go back here, splits over splitism. The other slide I could have added here is compare and contrast this meeting with the following summer, 2009, post-Urumqi, where Chinese Foreign Ministry circulates a draft statement supporting China's territorial integrity and supporting its actions in Urumqi, and within 24 hours, every SCO country has signed on to the communique, and it's out as a statement. Right? So for me, it's not a perfect comparison, but it's an instructive one, I would argue, that you see much more of, I think, China's security agenda being agreed upon than Russia's security agenda. And again, you know, the principle of separatism is one China, of course, takes very, very seriously. It's not willing to compromise on. Okay. A second set of views came out in the Western academic and NGO community around that time, a little bit later, 2006, 2007, and that is, that is the SCO some sort of authoritarian club? Does it promote authoritarian norms? Does it promote anti-Western values? And this was a big theme of the literature. Some scholars focused on what's the meaning of the Shanghai spirit, if this is new. They focused in on the doctrine of sovereign non-interference, right? Does sovereign non-interference also condone political repression or lack of political opposition and so forth? Tom Ambrosio on this, Amnesty International. Also, does the SCO unduly privilege state power as opposed to, say, civil society in some of these areas? So some of the political values issues that groups have looked at, does the SCO restrict democratic opposition under the three evils principle, separatism, terrorism, and extremism? Who's defined as an extremist, right? Under sort of what criteria? How do we know? And along those lines, is the SCO targeting Western NGOs working on democracy issues, some argued? There's also this business of SCO election monitors, right, that SCO election monitors go in and their evaluations of member countries' elections, like CIS monitors, tend to be quite the opposite of the OSCE ODIHR missions. And most recently, there's been a report by the Human Rights in China group on the RATS mechanism and then sort of human rights. And sort of two issues have been drawn attention. One is the practice of blacklisting and the practice of sort of institutionalized renditions under the RATS framework. We can talk about this in more detail in Q&A. Of course, you know, blacklisting and renditions are not just exclusive to the SCO, right? But the part of this I would draw attention to is a report by the UN Rapporteur for Human Rights and Anti-Terrorism that criticized the formulation of the RATS list and saying, what are the procedures for protecting people on the list, for getting them delisted, for grievance procedures? What are the procedures by which people on the list are vetted? There were also concerns expressed on sort of data mining and so forth. So I think some of the concerns about RATS are endemic, I think, to a lot of counterterrorism efforts. But I think there is a question as to, emerging question as to whether all parts of the RATS treaty are compatible with the emerging international legal regime on anti-terrorism and things like resolutions 1263 and so forth at the UN. So now we get to view three, and to me this is the most kind of interesting, and I think this is really the most relevant. I mean, you know, the authoritarian issues are important. I think there's some truth to some of these points, but remember what how ASEAN was described in its first decade, right? It was viewed as a club for dictators, as supporting these non-interference norms and so forth, and it has evolved remarkably as an institution and organization. So I think there is always the capacity for inter-institutional organizational involvement. But this view right here is, I think, really the crux of the matter. When we talk about potential for Western engagement, right? And this is where, I'm very much in agreement with some of the points that Huasheng made. Is the SCO a regional public goods provider for Central Asia, essentially, right? And Oksana Antonenko has written on this, Marcel De Haas, and they have framed the SCO as this kind of dynamic, does a lot of different things, fosters regional cooperation across a lot of issue areas, and that means that the EU, in these particular cases, has to engage with the organization, otherwise they're going to be left behind, right, in the chase for sort of Central Asia. This kind of urgency in the tone of a lot of these writings. So these include things from, you know, beyond the border resolutions that they successfully concluded to economic cooperation, trade, infrastructure, communications, partnerships for Afghanistan, and so forth. But the fact of the matter is, as Hwasheng has talked about, the economic agenda is stalled. So why? Right? And I want to sort of make the case here kind of a traditional reason and a not so traditional reason. Traditional reason is just differences within the members regarding relative gains from economic cooperation. It's that simple. China's economic potential is huge, in actuality is huge. Russia is very concerned about increasing trade and cooperation. The Central Asian states themselves, as Hwasheng has talked about, very concerned about the terms of trade patterns that they're going to be stuck in. And this is why you've seen a lot of SCO proposals to create a regional central bank, the interbank mechanism, and so forth, not really get anywhere, right? Sort of, you know, not willing to take it to the implementation phase. Lack of coordination in response to financial crisis. Very early on, Beijing identified the financial crisis as incredibly important for Central Asia and wanted to establish mechanisms to provide financing for infrastructure. They proposed it to Russia in October 2008 to create a $10 billion fund. Moscow said no. They reproduced and instead wanted to do bilateral deals with Belarus and Kyrgyzstan for some of these political quid pro quos. Then in June in Yekaterinburg in 2009, China proposed it again. Equal funding, equal control of the projects. Kremlin once again said no, to the dismay of some Russian analysts I've talked to. And they cited sort of an obscure law in the Duma against sort of funding multilateral financial institutions and so forth. So what did China do? They went ahead and they funded it anyway. So exclusively an SCO anti-crisis fund from Chinese money. So there you see some of the tensions involved over sort of economic control, not just sort of improving greater efficiency and cumulative gains, but sort of concerns about relative gains. Other part of the financial crisis, you all know, emphasizes Chinese strength, Russian weakness. Here you see the crossover in terms of trade partnerships between China and Russia. And you see the increasing volume of trade, and now China is the region's first trading partner, not Russia. This we mentioned. So the other not-so-obvious issue, and this is something I think Andy's also been looking at in some of his work in the NDN, is the kind of very particular institutional configurations of the Central Asian states themselves. And I agree with the points Hwasheng mentioned in terms of sort of, you know, barriers to economic cooperation. I would just kind of specify his fourth kind of rule of law point in this following way, is that borders themselves in Central Asia remain a source of personal patronage and revenue. They're commercialized, right? So it's not just that they're corrupt, that they are part of the patrimonial political system of these Central Asian states. So customs positions, border guards, security services, regulatory agencies, you know, all of these are ways to sort of reward political friends by giving them plum positions that they in turn use to sort of enrich themselves. So we see sort of a couple of issues, right? One is that in a lot of these areas that have been proposed, so electricity sector, communications, infrastructure, well, who controls these sectors in the Central Asian countries, right? The regimes and friends of the family, right? So what incentive do they have to actually integrate these sort of rent-making, money-making enterprises? Very little. Right, and so this is why you get a lot of agreements signed versus actually implemented of very few in this area, or to the degree that that was hoped. And one of the Central Asian former SCO directors said very candidly in an interview, look, we're becoming the CIS in terms of some of these agreements. We're signing all sorts of agreements at all sorts of levels, and they're just sitting there on the books. We're not implementing them, save the security issues that Hwasheng, I think, very correctly identified. So what do you do? You agree on things like anti-narcotics, even though they're one of the SCO members is perhaps the biggest part of the problem, which is the Tajik border guard. Future agenda. So what kinds of things can we look in terms of this regional public goods for the future? Potential plans to expand SCO technical assistance, modeled on sort of USAID-like, especially to Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, right, which are put in a basket of weak economic countries. I suppose rightly so. See plans on how to strategically disperse the $10 billion for high-impact infrastructure projects. And again, that, when you talk about sort of competition with international organizations, that really crowds out sort of the kind of lending that IFIs have been doing in the region. And possible talk, and I don't know, maybe Huasheng has thoughts on this, on will there be another energy mechanism developed to deal with some of the regional issues for these new trans-Central Asian pipelines? The gas pipeline from Turkmenistan that traverses Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and feeds into China, or the Kazakh pipeline, where you could discuss issues like security, like volume, even potentially price and so forth. So China resisted the energy club, but now that it has its energy infrastructure, perhaps it wants to open that up again. So what does all this mean for the West, for Europe, for Washington, for NATO, for Brussels? It's an extremely complicated picture because it depends what your priorities are. What agency are you in? What part of the world are you in? One of the challenging things about this project is a research project. Especially when I was talking to people at the U.S. State Department, I would speak with economic attachés in China, security people in Central Asia. I mean, just even the division of how we divide up the world would emphasize different parts of the SEO and view the SEO in different kinds of ways. So Western actors will respond to the SEO according to their different priorities, their competence, their values, their regional strategy. Example, EU versus NATO. So a lot of actors have been pushing for more EU formal recognition, and this has been resisted, mainly for two reasons. One is sort of some of the normative issues that the EU still views itself as a normative actor, right? So especially sort of the issue of separatism, until separatism is defined in a way that is more congruent with EU so-called rule of law and values, that it's difficult for the EU to offer a high-level engagement versus NATO, which is looking for a partner in Afghanistan, right? And for NATO, the kind of so-called values issues are secondary to finding a regional framework and a regional solution for Afghanistan. So NATO sees the SCO as a potential partner, or most people in NATO. There are some dissenters. But that's because they have very different sort of interests and strategic objectives than the EU. Also see them as preferable dealing with the CSTO, right? So it goes back and forth. There's another issue here, though, and that is what is the value of engaging with the SCO as an organization, as opposed to strengthening bilateral relations with regional actors? And that's not clear to me. Like, what is the value added for the West of dealing with the SCO as opposed to dealing with Beijing, dealing with the individual capitals? Huasheng very correctly talked about sort of this emerging IO competition for this limited Central Asian space. And one of the priorities of the Secretariat in Beijing is to find regional partners, to gather regional and international recognitions for the SCO. So they have good working relationships with the Asian Development Bank. They've been recognized now by the United Nations. So one of the priorities of over these years is to sort of secure more and more international recognition, sort of legitimacy for the organization. So part of the message sort of I would advise is engagement should be conditioned. And it, you know, why sort of give high level engagement away? Right, especially when the organization hasn't demonstrated yet competence in these third basket, basket of issues, that the public goods issues that we want them to. And this is sort of the one thing the organization needs. Why just sort of give that away? So what should be sought for? It depends. Promises for greater cooperation on Afghanistan, assistance, trainers, peacekeepers, maybe that's an issue. More transparency on RATS issues. SEO itself, RATS itself, said that they would release a public list of who is on that blacklist, and they have not yet, right? That could be an ask. An ask might be greater coordination with international organizations and financial institutions, right? So, you know, on the one hand, I think Central Asia desperately needs this financing for infrastructure and development, and I think in that sense, Chinese funds play a very positive role. But there is a question of how does sort of Chinese overseas lending through the SCO mechanism, how does that interface with international projects that are currently going on? So there might be sort of a condition that we talk about more coordination between the two. So I don't know what the conditions are potentially, what the basket of issues is. It really depends on the agency and depends on the organization. But the one thing I would stress is that
as we move to a relationship with the SCO, which I think we will, and I think is inevitable, the West needs to think about what does it want from the SCO in exchange for this blooming cooperation. So I'll just leave it at that. Thanks, Mr. Shin.
Thanks to both of you for really terrific presentations. Very, very complimentary and comprehensive. I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair and make the first questions, comments, and turn to you. Then I'll turn to for the floor for others. on your last point, Alex, about institutional cooperation, I mean, one institution that would seem to be more natural is the OSCE. Yeah. Given that, as Hua Sheng said, that it's on non-traditional security issues that the SCO has probably been most successful, and this is what the OSCE does principally, and in particularly with the OSCE's expanding interests into Eurasia and initial engagement in Afghanistan,
right.
That might be a... It strikes me initially more as a more natural partner than the EU or NATO, certainly. And this takes me to the question, because I want to give Hua Sheng an opportunity to talk about his Afghanistan slide. And yeah. I'd like to hear both of you talk some more about what you think the SCO could actually do in Afghanistan, its interest in Afghanistan, and how that might be an area where we would find a potential for cooperation. And I thought your last comment, Alex, about the Emergency Assistance Fund was spot on. And I was curious as to whether any of these funds have actually been allocated to this point. And you know, given the particularly you know the infrastructure and development, the ABD, Asian Development Bank, has been extremely active there, and certainly this is something. I mean, have the funds been allocated? If you have know anything more about to what degree there's been interaction with other regional funders, because as you know and I know, particularly looking at the experience in funding in Afghanistan over 10 years. The lack of cooperation, and different priorities, et cetera, is huge. So, let me give you guys an opportunity to take that, and then I'll put your hand up, and we'll start taking some questions and comments.
Jeff, I right here. I believe that with the eventual withdrawal of the American troops and troops of ISAF. The International Secret Assistance Forces. I know there's another reading that is I Saw America Fight. I believe that the local regions, regional countries and local organizations will bear more responsibilities. It's a very natural process. And SCO is including. So I will miss these points because it's just about history. And I read all of the documents of SCO that I find in every political documents that passed in SCO, there's a part on the issue of Afghanistan. So it's always in the agenda of SCO. And Putin also said the Afghanistan situation is one of the factors that stimulates the formation of SCO. But about what role for SCO to play in Afghanistan for near and middle future, that is the question. And I think SCO has both advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is, first, politically, all the state members, including the observers has a quite common political principle or attitudes towards Afghanistan, generally, politically. And the another advantage is the geographical location. I have, you can see the all the surrounding members of Afghanistan are all the state members or the observers, except Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, China, Pakistan as observer, Iran observer. So this is, sure, is one of the greatest advantages for ICU to play an important role in Afghanistan issue. The disadvantages. ICU did not possess common military forces. So if adverse process will happen in Afghanistan, I do not think ICU have enough means to stop it. This is one. And the another disadvantage is though we are the other state members and observers coming politically in their attitudes towards Afghanistan, still every state members have their specific interests. And for example, Pakistan have a very special relationship with Afghanistan, we know, particularly in the term of Taliban. And Tajikistan have a very big ethnic group in Afghanistan, the same with Uzbekistan and Russia. They, all of them mostly have a more close relationship with Northern Alliance, and most of their interests are in Northern path, and it's their priority, and Iran. And there's another problem for ICO to play to more effectively work in Afghanistan is that is, so every state members and observers have a close relationship with and offer they provide assistance in Afghanistan issue, but it's in a less coordinated way. So in more cases, individual or bilateral. Individually and in bilateral way. So how to cooperate and centralize or pool the resources together in a more coordinated way to deal with Afghanistan issue is also a problem for ICO. And what role ICO could play in Afghanistan issue, particularly after the 2014 with Kabul process and finished. Politically, there's some, at least a part of scholars, particularly in Central Asian states, in Kyrgyzstan, have long time argued that ICU could play a role of mediator for political reconciliation in Afghanistan, because ICO is not a side of fighting, is not a fighting sider inside the Afghanistan war. They support the anti-terrorist campaign, but it doesn't involve directly in military campaign. So it's easily to be accepted by most of the political groups inside Afghanistan. And in the role in security areas, I think ICO or the state members of ICO is the first preventive belt that prevent pure over of instability from Afghanistan to other regions. So SU is working with creating a preventive financial preventive belt and drug trafficking preventive belt. This is, I think, a very important role for SCO. And most important role that for SCO play, I think, is in economy. Afghanistan is an inland country. It's a very poor country. And it doesn't have much to offer to do business with very developed countries, but mostly proper form for economic cooperation is with the surrounding states. And this is, I think, the surrounding states are the main trade partner for Afghanistan. And the most important way for Afghanistan to recover its economy is to involve in a regional economic cooperation, regional cooperation, economic cooperation mechanism. SU is one of them. This is one. And Afghanistan is located in the heart of Central, South, and West Asia. So it's a lot of projects, transportation projects and energy projects in a great deal depends on the situation in Afghanistan or on Afghanistan. So with participation in Afghanistan, ICO could jointly with Afghanistan realize a lot of projects, transportation. For example, it can the access to sea, to Indian Sea for Central Asian states. It's also designed for them. And it, sure, realization of these projects will benefit for Afghanistan itself. And Afghanistan suffers from lack of energy. The surrounding states could provide energy. At present time, Uzbekistan, Russia, and Tajikistan provide electricity, gas, and oil to Afghanistan. And SU also could be one of important investor. China, Russia, and Kazakhstan have considerable potential to invest in Afghanistan. China has have a very big deal in Afghanistan. The total investment will accumulate to $4 billion American dollars in 5 years. So that's I think the most important role for us.
Right. Yeah. So no, that's the sort of more intriguing proposal is the one Wang mentioned that come the sort of a high profile scholar Alexander Knyasev in Kyrgyzstan, which is to create some sort of SCO dialogue, mediation, reconciliation process. And the idea here is that it would be modeled on the Tajik peace process, right? And you would sort of bring parties together under that kind of working framework. And there was a conference on this up at Issyk-Kul in 2008. There's a report out on it. I'm not sure what the status of that is or whether it ever got traction. That's one proposal. I think a lot of this is going to depend on, frankly, China and Russia deciding what they want to do about Afghanistan. I mean, in other words, it's hard to think about more robust SCO cooperative mechanisms in Afghanistan while the sort of two biggest, most important countries in the organization
are still wondering exactly how far to go in Afghanistan. Until they reconcile those or sort that out, I don't see how that gets translated at the SCO level. Of course, Andy, as you know, sort of the NDN talks with China on opening up the corridor. I mean, you know, China's put some conditions that, you know, goods transported through any kind of corridor should be Chinese, preferably made in Xinjiang, non-lethal, and so forth. But just the geography of it seems to sort of just preclude it. I mean, they're going through the Wakhan corridor. There was another proposal, China, Pakistan, Afghanistan, but given what the relationship with Pakistan is at the moment and the fact that we're going, what, 75-25 at the end of 2011 through the northern routes, I don't know if that's going to be viable or helpful in the grand scheme of things either, but you're more qualified to assess that than I am. So we get to, you know, the drug trafficking issue, which is, I think, you know, the kind of everyone, you know, has consensus about drug trafficking and its importance and to stem it out. But again, part of the problem there is the institutional weakness of particularly the Tajik-Afghan border and, of course, the Turkmen-Afghan border. And Turkmenistan's not a party of the SCO. And actually, on the narcotics issue, this actually does matter because you don't have SCO programs and so forth launched there. So the drug trafficking, it's the sort of default issue. But in some ways, it's the default issue because we can't get momentum for more active steps. And I think the suggestions about infrastructure are definitely more intriguing. This business on stabilization fund, has it been allocated yet? My understanding is no, that it the final list of projects is still at the tail end of being decided. Apparently they're going to be announced, I don't know, maybe Washington has more accurate information on this, at the 10th anniversary summit. They're going to announce the projects and who's going to get what. Part of the methodological difficulty for me as an outside academic, and of course it would help a lot if I spoke Mandarin, but I don't, is that sometimes projects that are Chinese in origin in Central Asia are referred to as SCO. And so then I sort of say, oh, is this really an SCO project? But sometimes it's a Chinese project that's termed SCO after the fact. So it makes it difficult to keep tabs on what's counted in the SCO bucket versus not. So, for instance, will this new, you know, $5 billion loan to Uzbekistan, will some of that come out of the SCO pot or not? You know, I don't know. I think it will, but I'm not sure which part and for what purposes. So that's just a methodological point that has sort of practical implications.
Okay, you've been waiting a long time. I've got Bob Newark, then Peter. Take time, okay?
Thanks very much, Andy, and thanks very much to our speakers for two very interesting presentations. I have two quick sets of questions. The first concerns the observation that in the security areas, success has been largely in the non-traditional areas. Could our speakers elaborate on that a bit? What are the areas where you would judge that this has taken place, where success has been greatest? And secondly, why? What are the reasons that for success there? Perhaps more importantly, what are the obstacles to progress in some of the more traditional areas? Obviously, Russian policy with respect to CSTO is part of the explanation, but what else is there? What are the other structural policy issues that explain it? Second set of questions, again, as a follow-up to yours, Andy, about Afghanistan, and it was sparked by Alexander Cooley's observation that one of the conditionalities for engagement might be cooperation, and you listed, as I recall, training, assistance, and peacekeeping. And the question, again, two-part question, how would you judge SCO capacities in this area, both multilaterally and by its members? But secondly, perhaps more interesting, how would you judge that engagement in those areas would relate to the possible political role you've talked about as a mediator? I can think about ways in which these might complement or reinforce this political role, but also ways in which it would frustrate it. So I'd be very interested in hearing your thoughts about those.
All right. Thanks. Peter, and please identify yourself for our
Thank you for those two very interesting presentations. I think this is a very good question that Robert is asking about the peacekeeping potential for SEO. But my question would be a little bit more general and abstract. As you certainly know, Russian leaders quite often say that creation of SEO is an indication of the new world, as they call it, multipolar world, where the United States doesn't play as important a role as it used to play. And perhaps it's what you Alex, mentioned as what they think is a new type of international relations. My question is, how would you comment on that idea in general? And I'm in general very interested how contemporary U.S. scholars view this attitude and this perception. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Josh Kuchera. Josh Kuchera, a freelance journalist here. You know, a few weeks ago, Assistant Secretary Robert Blake proposed the U.S. might, you know, engage in some cooperation with the SEO. And it wasn't very specific, but I'm curious, especially Dr. Zhao, you know, what do you think SEO members, in particular China, would, you know, would think about that? Are they interested in the U.S. cooperation? And if so, in what capacity?
Okay, let's take those three questions and try to be concise so that we can get another round or two of questions, comments. Huasheng, why don't you go first?
Yeah. Interesting phenomenon is that every state members of SEO have cooperation with the United States, but the SEO as in general, as an organization in whole, do not have any formal relationship with U.S. But mostly, I think it's because of the policy of the United States, not because of the SEO. And with the administration of Obama administration, I think the situation have some changes because of the need for to deal with Afghanistan issue. So SEO is in this context, SEO is a little more needed for the United States than before. And last month, for the first time, China and the United States have a dialogue, particularly on Central Asia, in the framework of China, the United States strategic economic cooperation. I think before it, the United States have a dialogue with Russia, with all Central Asian states. This is the last one. It's also progress. And the cooperation between, the possibility of cooperation between China, between SEO and the United States depends both on the will of the United States and the will of SEO. And though the topic of military presence of the United States in Central Asia is not so hot as before, but it still remains a problem, particularly for China and for Russia. Though China and Russia do not against the presence of the United States in Central Asia, but military, long-time military presence of the United States in Central Asia, I do not think will be welcomed by China and Russia all the time. So on the one hand, it's possible for U.S. and SEO to cooperate, particularly at this time and for near future because of Afghanistan, and on the issues such as drug trafficking and regional stability. But on the other hand, there are still some obstacles geopolitical, from the point of view of geopolitical understanding. Yeah. So maybe the cooperation is possible, but it's limited. It's technological cooperation is more possible.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think in terms of your point about capacity for, you know, kind of robust peacekeeping, it's not there. But neither is the political will. And so a lot of this really depends on China's policy towards Afghanistan. And at the moment, it's very much one of wanting to tread carefully and sort of a fear that more active involvement on the ground with peacekeepers or security guards or direct security for Chinese investments would boomerang back on them into sort of Xinjiang. I mean, you know, that's the point. It says, and we were talking about this before the session, everyone wants stability in Afghanistan. The problem is stability in Afghanistan is wanted for different things, and that affects the differences in strategies. So for China, that's trying to maintain still a low profile in Afghanistan for fear of sort of repercussions back home. So that's a fundamental piece of the puzzle here. You know, also the training missions aren't peacekeeping missions. They're kind of regime change, anti-terrorist types of missions, right? So that's not what they've been training. Maybe they will in the future, and maybe that's something they need to go to. Internal security, successes, institutionalized cooperation between ministries of interior, the RATS database, the RATS blacklist, the RATS cooperative security arrangements. Incidentally, there's some interesting dissent by some journalists in places like Russia where they see Russia as now having green-lighted the ability of Central Asian security services to operate in Russia by signing this agreement, right? And so Russia used to be a space where political dissidents, Central Asian opposition leaders could actually set up shop. And now, with some recent cases that have gone to European court, they haven't specifically talked about the SCO mechanism because that's never revealed, but there's some sort of supranational mechanism of understanding going on that is bypassing traditional extradition laws and procedures and so forth. Cybersecurity, very successful. Again, depends on how you define success. But you have a lot of technology transfer to the Central Asian states to sort of augment their cybersecurity capacity. So all those areas. Multipolar question is a great one. There is a group of scholars working on so-called what the world without the West, you know, what would it look like? I guess what interests me is, are the problems of international organizations culturally specific to the West, or are they just organizational problems? And I tend to come down on the latter, that, you know, I don't think it's about Western centrism to talk about, you know, it's very difficult when you have one economically dominant organization, power in an organization, to reassure the others that they should open up trade. I think that would be true if you replace China with any other country in terms of sort of its members there. That's a structural, I think, problem. And so I give this talk or variants of this talk sometimes overseas, and you can almost sense the palpable kind of disappointment that it hasn't worked out yet. Because I think there's a kind of a deeper sociological thing. What would a multipolar world look like, right? If you didn't have, you know, the West imposing its conditions and so forth. And I think the jury's still really out on that. Right? And so I think what you see with the SCO and some of its weaknesses are very, you know, I think, kinds of common growing pains to large organizations. Also, let's not forget, 2002, it was really right after sort of 9/11 that China almost single-handedly revived the SCO project. I mean, they tried to reinvigorate the agenda. They got meetings on different issues because they saw all of a sudden that the U.S. was dealing bilaterally with all the Central Asian states, and they really rejuvenated the agenda. So the jury's still out, but I don't tend to see anything more kind of special or nuanced because it's non-Western. Maybe in the norms and so forth, but in practice, no.
Yes, right here, sir.
Stuart Goldman, National Council for Eurasian and East European Research. I have a question that's specific to Iran, but touches both on the enlargement question and possibly on questions of relations and possible tension between Russia and China. Professor Zhao, you correctly remind us that Russia's position on Iranian membership is that as long as Iran is in violation of UN IAEA resolutions, it's not a candidate. But I was told by several different high-level Chinese sources that prior to Iran's rejecting the Russian proposal for enrichment on Russian territory, that at I think at the 2007 SCO summit, prior to the actual beginning of the summit, Russia brought forward a draft proposal for Iranian membership, and that China warned the Russians mm-hmm. off, and that China said, no, that's not, we will not support that. And so it wasn't brought forward at that summit meeting. If that's correct, I interpret that as a Chinese reluctance to have the SEO viewed in Washington as such a hostile anti, such an organization that's so hostile to this very high level U.S. priority. Can either of you comment on the validity of both of the alleged event and this interpretation of it?
Okay, Gil?
I have a parallel question moving forward 3 years. The parallel is in 2010, China was the more assertive party and compared to Russia. And we see inside China some efforts to question this assertiveness. And for instance, on the six-party talks and the way China dealt with North Korea and on South China Sea and Southeast Asia, we get a kind of a struggle in China over, is China going too far and alienating other countries? And I wonder on the SCO, I saw some Chinese articles that were quite critical of Russian cooperation with the United States on Central Asia and Afghanistan. And was there some pushback in China on this issue too, and saying maybe we have to be more conciliatory and not be so aggressive?
Time for one more question, comment? No, we don't. Okay. Panels, last comments. Two excellent questions.
I've got something for you on that, Gil.
I do not have information about that Russia have backed Iran in 2006 or 2005, because, in general, I have no such information, but before the last year, there's a consensus among all the state members that the enlargement is in, it should not be in the target in for ACO. So this is not the topic for ACO. And the consensus is that at present time, we should not enlarge itself, but increase our efficiency before 1 year. So I do not think it's quite possible. And now Iran has economically and in the terms of energy cooperation, Iran could be of great importance for ACO and for the region. So why to settle this problem? But because Iran is not and is not important, it's not impossible for near future or for middle for future to be the former membership. How to settle this problem? So now I think the approach is that SEO is going to increase the possibility of economic cooperation inside, in the framework of observation, observers. So even though Iran is not a formal membership of SEO, but in the framework of observer, SEO also could realize some projects. That is a solution. That's a solution. And about Russia and Central Asia, the criticism of Russia, I would say it's mainly, I guess, mainly related to the change, the abstract change of Russian policy in after the September 11th. And it's not because of, if there is some criticism, it's not because of Russia's cooperation with the United States. Because mainly some people think that that Russia's change is sometimes it's not very unpredictable. And it can make a sharp change without informing their partners. Maybe if there are some criticism for not for the cooperation itself, but for this.
Yeah. So I've heard your formulation as well. I don't know how much of it's true. I wasn't in the room. I would just flip it though as a marker and say if you ever saw China entertaining or the SEO entertaining Iranian full membership again, to me that would be a red flag about the state of U.S.-Chinese relations, right? And then just the point about attitudes, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because this gets back to the gentleman's question there. China's really invested itself in multilateralism as a framework for sort of what it's doing in Central Asia in this kind of SEO experiment. And so sort of a lot of the rhetoric of criticism really is kind of based on that, you know, appealing to sort of multilateral kind of principles and kinds of norms and mutual trust and cooperation and so forth. So, you know, I'm by no means a Chinese foreign policy expert, but it seems to me a really a fascinating foray for Beijing to sort of couch whatever it's doing in Central Asia, whether it actually is or not, in this kind of multilateral framework.
Just a quick comment to your question, Stuart. I don't have a definitive answer, but it is that the Russians would move forward with this proposal in 2007 is sounds right. The U.S.-Russia relationship was declining dramatically. But I would speculate that today the Russians would not want to move forward with a similar proposal, given the way it would be interpreted and where the U.S.-Russia relationship has gone. On the, but I've also heard from Russian colleagues that the that Putin was very disappointed that Ahmadinejad and the Iranians did not take him up on the offer. And that had a significant impact on the personal relationship. So that the timing of that is kind of interesting. I wonder whether the I think Putin felt like he was stiffed, and it was my understanding that he was also operating sort of with the, you know, the understanding, if not support, from the U.S. government. You know, okay, hey, you can be successful in convincing Tehran to do this. You know, more power to you. But it didn't work out that way. This has been a great discussion. I know that Alex has got to catch a train back up to New York. Just want to say, Alex, you not that you need job security right now, just having gotten tenure, but certainly I think there's a lot of job security in the last point you raised, or one of your last points, about thinking about how institutional frameworks for multilateral cooperation as we move toward a real multipolar world and what works and what doesn't work. We're going to be with that one for a long, long, long time. So thanks very much, guys. Very stimulating discussion. Thank you for coming, and we'll see you soon.